Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/westwoodone.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime, and my second feature script, Ricky and the Ooze, has been written, which is great.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I am getting ready to make my third one, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep and a distribution consultant, and I used to work at Sundance.
On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 368 from April 2022 with Tallgrass Film Festival director and producer Melanie Addington, who talks about working at film festivals and producing her own work at the same time. I felt Melanie was a good match for Rachel because they are both film festival directors, and they both make their own films in between running their fests. So perfect correlation there. After that, we play another round of Y'all the Expert. But first, don't forget to check out our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast. This is how the show continues to live, continues to exist, to thrive, to grow. Also, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or a rating. Both really help. But without any more further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Melanie Addington.
Mel, thank you for joining us today. Can you give us the elevator pitch for your short Golden Years?
Yeah, so I produced the Golden Years as part of a longstanding project where the festival I worked for before Oxford Film Festival helped brand new directors learn how to make a movie. And so we produced the film, both executive produced the tiny little bit of catering budget, and then produced, got everything together for them. So it was a very fun, challenging project each year, working with all new everything. So.
And then how many days did you shoot?
You know, we only shot 2 days and then some pickup shots. It was a very simple shoot, but there were a lot of rehearsal days because the director had a theater background. So he and the two actors just really got together and rehearsed a lot before.
What can you speak of with regard to the budget?
Well, being a festival budget, it was definitely, actually that project was SAG. So the actors received SAG. And in fact, we had a really cute scene that a dog accidentally ran into. And then we learned all the rules with animals are harder than actors on SAG. So we cut that. So that was interesting. And then these are all very minimal shorts that are shot through the lens of the film fest. And so there's a very small amount set aside to pay actors and to pay for food. But all the crew, it's considered a learning experience. And so we all actually pitch in for free. I guess technically I didn't, since I was like the paid employee making sure it happened. So yeah, it's definitely not probably the best model, but you know, it's that old style of making something together with your friends. So we kind of gave them the framework and some funding to be able to go out there, and they didn't have to find equipment. We brought all of that in for them. So it's really just showing up for a weekend and learning how to film.
And how did the idea come about, or how did you guys decide that this was going to be the short to produce?
So every year was different. This actually started as a collaborative project with Kodak way back in the day, where we actually filmed the first one on film, right in the transition. So after that, every year has been digital. So when it started, Kodak gave us funding and free film to bring in a professional crew to train new actors. And then we sort of reversed the model to especially because in Mississippi, there were film incentives being taken away, then brought back. The main problem with the state was that all the crew moved to Atlanta and New Orleans. So we had to rebuild our crew base in the state. And so this was us trying to help strengthen that and teach people that maybe can't take a film class or whatever. This gave them a free weekend to try it out. So it really shifted gears from its original point.
It's interesting. How long did y'all spend working on this specific film from it being brought to you to its release into the world?
Yeah, because I don't think I ever actually, we had a filmmaker, a script writer actually had several films that had been made of his shorts play at the festival the year before. And he said, oh, are you ever looking for scripts? And I happened to mention we do this community film. So that was 2 years out. And then the year before he won or was runner up, it's been a while, for our script competition. We did a short script competition at Oxford. And so we made it that the winner actually is the thing that gets produced the next year. So that one was easy. In the early days, it was us trying to help fledgling screenwriters or doing competitions. And there's all lots of convoluted, complicated ways to find a good idea. So,
I mean, so it was a year ago, you said a year out, right? When you found the script. Mm-hmm. And then did you jump right into production from then on? Or what was the detail of the calendar?
So the next step is to do sort of an informal call and then a formal call of who even wants to learn how to be a director. And I had actually, this one specifically, our LGBTQIA programmer, Brian Wisenant, had always said he's going to make a film one day. And he's one of those that needed a little push. So I went to him directly and asked him, like, you've been saying, I've known you 6 years now, that you're going to one day make a film. I said, what about this one? Because somebody did that to me. And that's how I got involved in filmmaking. And so he said, if I think about it, I'll say no. So yes. And I roped him in at a random party in the corner. So this one was really easy to come together because reading it, we knew instantly our two friends, Johnny and Susan McPhail, who are professional actors and who are SAG, were the perfect couple for this. And so of all the films I've produced, it's probably accidentally the easiest, other than a stage director learning what a frame is. I think that was our biggest challenge, was the cinematographer and our fledgling director working together.
And then compared to all the other projects you've made, how difficult was this one to make?
Yeah, well, I still have one that I've been working on for 8 years and still hasn't been released. So that's my 11. So maybe like a 4.
Well, jumping into like our main questions, I make some of our guests do this and I hope you don't mind me putting you on the spot. But can you kind of tell your own story, define yourself? Because in addition to like heading film festivals, you're a producer, you're a writer, you're a journalist. I'm just trying to kind of figure you out in your entirety.
Great question. Okay. Me too. Thank you. Why don't you tell me, Liz? Go. I don't know what I am. I loved films. I saw Howard the Duck when I was 7. And yes, I know. But I was like, how did they make this movie? It was just magic to me. So I kept learning. So I started as a writer. And then when I got into college, I was an English major and a film minor. And they didn't have a film critic on the school paper. So I thought I would start writing because that was an easy way to see films for free, which still is. So that worked out. But I was destined to be a teacher and that didn't happen. So I really randomly fell into news reporting while volunteering at film festivals, totally oblivious to the idea that I could even help shape one ever. That was not in my head. I had friends that were filmmakers in high school and college. So I was like, cool, I'll watch it. And so it was just very random what happened in my life because I have sort of three loves. I love higher ed. In fact, I got a master's in it, which I really don't use. But I was working on campus and I was a reporter and then I was volunteering with the film fest. And my life kept sort of shifting back down to the stuff that really mattered. And for me, that was the film component. So really, like I worked for a pizza magazine for a while, which believe me, I still love pizza. That hasn't changed. But I really, really just loved writing films, writing about films. And then really, I tried my hand at directing and learned I'm not really a director. But I loved the idea of making films happen, knowing that you were the one that thought of that location or you found this person to work on it. And that's what made it, you know, I just love that whole idea of producing. So did that answer that? I keep wandering off.
No, it did. I mean, I want to know how Oxford and Tallgrass came into the picture, but maybe, but I also feel like I'm hogging you. So Alric, jump in and then we'll get to it after.
I was just going to ask about Oxford because you were there 17 years. You were the executive director for 5. Why, after being there for so long, like, why did you decide to move on to Tallgrass? Like, what was the, you know, it seems like you were like kind of an institution at this festival. And then like suddenly you're at a new festival. So I'd love to hear about that decision.
Sure. It was a few things. I moved around the entire country my entire K through 12 years. My parents were always moving. So it was wonderful. And I still love moving. I love experiencing new places. But my son, I really wanted stability for him. So once I moved to Oxford, he stayed in one K through 12 system. Well, then he graduated. And I was like, well, that was my tie here. And I still love the town, but it keeps getting more and more expensive. It was really hard to live there. In fact, anyone that was a worker there, not a student funded by a parent, there was nowhere to live. It was so expensive. And so I had been to Tallgrass years ago when Leila Med O'Connor, amazing Mama Film now, she was running it and I fell in love with it. I don't know why. It's something gritty about it. It's a little bit like Memphis, but like a little bit nicer, a little Midwestern values. But it's just so nice. And it's literally the most affordable place to live in America. Don't cut that because I don't want anyone to know that. You don't have to. And so I just interviewed really because I thought, you know, I moved to Mississippi to learn about journalism and I loved it. But then now I'm in this new career I never planned to be in. Is this a fluke just because I happen to be the only local who would do it? Or is this something I can do as a real career? So I interviewed just seeing if I'd even get a job interview and then didn't really think about it again because they interviewed me months before and was running the festival. And literally the board of directors up here called me mid-Oxford Festival. It was like, hey, I'm sorry it took so long. We had some funding. We want to make sure it worked out and offered me the job. So very random story. I know. That's most of my life though. I think you can define it by randomness.
Wait, you didn't think you were qualified after running a film festival for 17 years?
I have self-esteem issues. I try, but yeah. But you know, when you're only at one job, you're like, this is the one job I know. I don't know how it translates to another. So it worked, I guess. Well, I don't know. We opened a new cinema, so I'm not failing yet. So,
can you talk a little bit how you got to Oxford in the first place? Like you combining all of your interests into heading a film festival?
Yeah, I was in my undergrad at Cal State San Marcos, which is northern San Diego, which is mostly where I'm from. I was born in Los Angeles. And my teacher in my memoir writing class came back and was talking about this amazing place she just went to called Oxford. There's this great independent bookstore. And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. Started talking about their master's program. So I started looking into it. And honestly, I applied to NYU. And that was my big dream. I'm going to go to New York along with everyone else. And I got in and then I got what it would cost for 1 year at NYU, which was all 4 years at the University of Mississippi. And I, you know, I wasn't getting like a specialized film degree. This is just like journalism. And they had a good journalism program. So I moved there and loved it and fell in love with the town, fell in love with the sort of artsy. It was very much a writer's haven. There were like two filmmakers when I moved there, but then the festival started. And I just really, if you ever go to Oxford, it's a very special little place. So
wait, but you still haven't told us how you got to be.
Thank you for keeping me on cue. I'm terrible at that.
Well, it's my curiosity that's doing it.
Yeah, it was all very random. I mean, I was working on campus and then I finally got a job as a reporter, which was, you know, my dream from the start, which is why I was there. So when that finally happened, it was very exciting. But then I got a job at a pizza magazine and all of a sudden, literally the entire world opened up because suddenly I was traveling all over the world, going to Italy once a year, doing all this video work and social media and all this stuff. And it just made a lot of sense when the other three volunteer co-directors at Oxford were like, we can't do this anymore. We're too busy. This is getting too big. I was the one that stepped in and said, I honestly love this and it still lets me write. So I'll do it. And so it was really sort of a fluke at first, but then I obviously proved myself a few times. So
just for someone who doesn't really know anything, what's the difference between a development director and executive director? Because they both have director in the title, right? But like they must be obviously made way different jobs. So can you talk about like what you did in those first 11 years before you took over as executive director?
Yeah, it's less difference than you think. The development director really is in charge of a lot of the fundraising. So developing out the sponsors and the community partners and doing a lot of that stuff. And so when I took over as executive director, I already had those relationships in place. And so it was really just building upon that, also adding some grant writing, also sort of looking at the larger puzzle of the festival and going, okay, this is all the pieces. Now, you know, programmers do your part, hospitality do your part. So just producing, really. It's all just producing. It's really the same.
I'm trying to figure out which question to ask you. Well, let's talk a little bit about programming and like how films are picked to play, because I'm curious. Like, I know programmers put forth titles that they want to go through, but are you like the ultimate decider? Are you screening alongside with them? How does the ED factor into all these decisions regarding programming?
I think it really does depend festival to festival. I usually helped with opening and closing, and if we had a centerpiece, and then the occasional special film. My role really for the programmers was to navigate the emails, because there's, you know, hundreds, especially at Oxford, where we offered feedback if anyone asked, which could mean 4,000 people asking on the same day. So I was really just doing the admin stuff and then saying, hey, by the way, this is an alum, you should check it out, flagging it. But I try, and same at Tallgrass, I try to stay out of the programmer's way because they have a vision. Although I have to watch the films. I want to know what I'm telling people to come see, because it's not fair for me to be like, yeah, it's going to be great. And then it's like really bad stuff that one year, you know? So I tend to stay as involved as I can watching most of the films. And then my programmer at Tallgrass lives in Berlin, Germany, and he comes back for the festival. He's from Wichita. And so I tend to have to represent at festivals where he would probably normally do that.
And do you ever find yourself in a situation where like you watch some of the films that have been selected and you're like, wait, this is not up to the quality that we have at the festival, or like maybe isn't like in line with the brand maybe? And has that ever happened? And then what do you do in that situation?
Yeah, no. So our brand is stubbornly independent. So I think maybe if something's too big and about to be released the next week on Netflix per se, I would probably ask why we're giving a slot away to them. But in general, everyone has a different opinion. And just because one film's not my cup of tea doesn't mean it's somebody else in our audiences. And that's my programmer's job. So I have to trust him and hope that's really going to work out. And the ticket sales show repeatedly that it did. So
I remember when the pandemic started, you wrote a piece for Movie Maker, Filmmaker. I always get them mixed up.
Oh, probably Movie Maker.
Probably Movie Maker.
Yeah.
About the importance of regional film festivals. And can we have a little taste of that here? Can you talk a little bit about why you believe that we shall be supporting regional film festivals, which is an argument I want to amplify for what it's
worth. Yeah, I studied art history alongside film in school. And where American art really took off is when people actually bothered to leave New York or LA and see what the rest of the country was about. And regional painting exploded. Most people don't know very much about Georgia O'Keeffe's New York art, but they know a lot about our New Mexico art. As a weird side example, the same thing has happened in filmmaking. Once the equipment was there, people realized they didn't have to be in two towns. They could live anywhere and turn on a camera. And that's the same for film festivals. I mean, yes, we're still living in a model where you have to be in New York or LA to qualify, et cetera, et cetera. But I have found the most interesting films, often sometimes ignored by the bigger areas, to be the most interesting, most challenging, and unique voices. I mean, I find more interesting things out of Sidewalk Film Festival than I'm going to, no offense, I like lots of things at Sundance. There's great stuff. But I have always found that the larger regional festivals are willing to take a chance and their audiences are hungrier for more stuff. And I think that's really interesting.
I have a follow-up. I'm just going to ask it. I'm starting to do sales, but folded into that is sometimes some festival repping. And it's very interesting to watch that in a more intimate vantage point, seeing where nepotism takes hold and where it doesn't, and where it's not nepotism, where there's actually people screening the work and there's actual communication and back and forth between filmmaker and programmers. Can you talk a little bit about the open doors of the regional film festival and the willingness to accept content that doesn't come from Cinetic and Submarine and whatever?
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of that goes to Film Festival Alliance and really trying to, in the past 10 to 15 years, say, hey, let's be more ethical and treat people. And also, I think at a lot of regional fests, they start it in their hometown because they're the filmmaker. And so they care about the filmmaker. if that makes sense. And so I think there's a lot of that sort of cultivation locally that makes you want to try stuff out and be more experimental. And also you don't have the same type of fiscal sponsorship you have to worry about at a larger fest where, you know, L'Oreal's not going to call me in Wichita and be upset that we showed an animal factory. Like, it's just not going to impact as much, but it will impact the audiences. That's a really random way to answer that, but if that works.
So in switching from Oxford to Tallgrass, like, did your like approach to being an executive director change at all? Like, did you have to adjust to a different type of film festival, or did you just sort of like take your indie spirit and, you know, transplant it over to Tallgrass?
Well, I was stubborn before Tallgrass, but no, I mean, it is a different structure. One, I was in a small town in the South. Now I'm in the exact middle of the country in the largest city in Kansas, which is a very small city in most places. But it's number one, there's different sentimentality and thoughts of Midwesterners than Southerners, somewhat. There's also similar. So really for me, the festival structures differently with how many staff they have, what they do. There's certain things that they do that I already knew about and liked. And then I was already doing that. Like, their hospitality is always stellar. They take care of the filmmakers in every way they can. So there was stuff that I just said, oh, that sounds great, let's keep doing it. And then there was stuff that was really part of the larger national conversation. You know, seasonal workers weren't paid very well, so I'm slowly increasing that. So trying to improve upon things that I think we're all learning at every festival right now. So yes and no is my answer.
I want to talk a little bit about you as a producer. How do you build your day? Like, how do you schedule out your day when you are overseeing a film festival? You have a family, and this is not a uniquely female question. I'm just, you know, and it sounds like you really enjoy artist support when you produce. So I'm just trying to figure out, how do you find the projects, and then how do you carve out the time to support the projects?
Pre-pandemic, I was a lot more organized. And, you know, like Monday from 8 to 4 was this. And then, you know, it was ridiculous. Now I'm just sort of chaotic and things keep happening. I honestly haven't been looking for a project since the pandemic started. One, because I'm still trying to close out this documentary feature that just keeps getting shifted to different places. And two, you know, pandemic burnout and life is exhausting. My husband has asthma. I'm, you know, disabled. And so there's a lot of high risk factors. So I kind of just stopped looking for projects. But then everyone else started thinking of new ideas. And they're like, oh, Melanie's supportive. So I've actually been approached a lot more than normal the past year. And I think the positive of that, because I've slowed down a bit, is that I have the time to read and think and say yes to only what I really think I could add value to. Before, when I was new, it was like yes to everything because you want to learn and experience.
When you come on, like you're saying, like you're selecting these projects and like deciding which one to come on to, like, how does it work? Do you like join the team kind of, you know, as one of like, you know, as an indie filmmaker? Are you coming in as like, no, I have a rate and this is what I charge, this is a contract? Like how do you approach when you pick up on a project?
Yeah, I'm not PGA. I'm very, very low budget indie. I don't come in with plans. It really depends per project. And, you know, sometimes I said no to a project this year because they had these really great grandiose ideas and I'm not the person to find them anything for that. So I just said no and said, here, you should talk to this person. I think they'd be a better fit. But yeah, it's very, there's no organization to that. It's very random. It's always been, I guess, my side gig compared to the festival, since that does consume 89% of my life.
An unformed question. Hopefully it will be formed for the time.
Well, it'll match my unformed answers. That's so.
I mean, it's a conversation after all. You know, what would be an ideal ecosystem for fostering creative voices? I mean, you've been a part of these film festivals, you produce content, you've written about content as a journalist. So I'm just trying to figure out, like, all of us are kind of drowning, trying to break out, so to speak. And a lot of us don't really take a lot of time in fostering like what the actual vision is. So I'm just curious what you would see as an ideal atmosphere for creating art.
I don't know if this is ideal. This is what I've been trying to do since I moved to Wichita, because all of a sudden, where I've been doing a lot of pre-production work in Mississippi, mostly locations, extra casting, that sort of stuff, I don't know anyone or what AV equipment we have here or anything. And so since I had the power of having Tallgrass behind me, started a Film Alliance. And I was like, I'll just bring them all in one place and then I can start learning. And what I learned very quickly is that what we're seeing in the regional scene specifically are the people who couldn't afford to move somewhere and afford film school, but they're trying and they're trying to figure it out, is that they need someone to say, okay, here's the pieces that you're missing. Let's start educating you locally. So we're literally doing different classes every month with our locals. And this is not students. This is 18 up that didn't go to film school. So these are the adults at 40 trying to pick up a camera for the first time and really just cultivate this idea. And in doing so helps me, because then I'm like, okay, this guy's a really good script writer and this one's a really good. And so just kind of pulling all these pieces together locally and asking them, what do you want? And just giving them that back along with stuff that I think they need that they don't know yet. So yeah. So just trying to cultivate people around you. What is it Mark Duplass always says, like pick up a camera and go make something with your friends. It's the same at the larger level, where then you have to start figuring out financing and marketing. You still are trying to make stuff with people you like. So
I want to ask a question about like vetting film festivals and like how filmmakers should be selecting which ones to apply to, like in is that important? Like, or I mean, yes. Obviously is, because we can't apply to every film festival in the world with our movies, right?
Like, oh my gosh, filmmakers really throw so much money away. Like, oh my gosh, if you know, like my entire heart is set on this festival. Don't submit to anything that accepts or is before that if you know you're not going to play it. That's like step number one. You throw away your money. Step number two is no, nobody's impressed by your 200 laurels of awards mills.
Thank you.
As somebody watching those films is go, ooh, red flag.
It makes it worse, right?
Yeah, it makes it worse. It says that you don't know how to research. You don't know how to think about what matters for your film and cultivating your audience. It says that you don't really know what you want. You're just throwing it against the wall. It says you're not professional to me. If somebody is cultivating something, and like Liz, can I say this? Like Liz had a film that we ended up not being able to play, but we were in her trajectory. We're in her plan and life changes. It happens. And she communicated with us instead of waiting till we announced.
But it's still like a big regret of my life.
But you communicated and look, we're still friends and we're still talking. The ones who don't communicate, and then you're like, oh, cool. Well, I just threw away your slot to somebody else. So, I mean, I've learned over the years to give filmmakers some time, because there's a lot of things happening all at once. Then their notifications are being figured out. And then I always have like a, oh, that film was so close. If I had room, I'd keep it. And so I hold those back as long as I can for those chances that happen. But the thing is, there are really great like student film showcases. There are things that you can do to build you up well before you get to Sundance. So assuming, oh, I just picked up this camera and made a documentary. Obviously Sundance will want it. Here's my $100. No, you're just wasting everyone's time. Really learn, like you could actually just go volunteer at a film festival or screen for a film festival and watch what they pick and how they pick it. And it's such great research. That's how I learned.
Can you talk a little bit about the complications of what you alluded to at the top of that answer? Like, I know, again, from just starting to do this work, that there's this very shitty situation that regional film festivals are thrown into, because filmmakers who are delusional want to wait until those career catapulting festivals get back to them before they respond to the film festivals that actually support them, the regional film festivals.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to like feed an answer. I just was curious what your thoughts were about being stuck in that like very frustrating situation.
So it happens. So like Craig Brewer and the Duplass brothers got discovered at Sundance 10, 15 years into their careers. And so both of them continue to give back. They're my good examples of like, Craig Brewer still tries to bring films to Memphis. That's where he's from. Oxford Film Festival is the first one to ever show one of his movies. He still brings projects there. That's the good side of it. The bad side is, oh, you're a stepping stone until I make it big and then I don't need you anymore. That happens way more than the positive side, unfortunately. And I get it, because you hear these like, oh, this person was discovered at Berlin. So that's the only place I can play to make it like they did. And that's not the model. They just, unfortunately, we get this much room to write an article, and it's my fault too as media. We rip out all the like long details getting you to that road. So,
but also like the absurdity of festival premieres and protecting them. I mean, maybe I shouldn't call it absurdity. I think it's absurd, but I don't, you know, is it something that complicates your selection process where people are playing that waiting game.
Yeah. And again, no offense, Liz, but that's really the sales agents more than anyone. I mean, I think, you know, like the team at Sundance doesn't care if it played in Podunk, Ohio. It's not changing their lives, but the distributors and sales agents, that's the game that everyone's trying to play too, rather than spirit of discovery and fresh ideas. So that's where we are now. I hope it collapses completely and we have to rebuild, honestly.
So do you feel like it's less important where a premiere film premieres and more important just like, you know, the audiences that it reaches?
I mean, no. I mean, that's ideal. That's my utopia that it would be. But I think anyone who's trying to guide you to distribution in the United States would say you need to be at this festival or this festival. There's two or three that could be the one that people will pick you up at. But I think there's quite a choir of voices. I mean, I feel like I've been the one shouting this for a long time, but it feels like a lot of people are picking up that steam of like, oh, wait, I just saw this amazing film at Cleveland, which is a great festival, but like it can world premiere there and still actually have legs. And I think what the positive of the pandemic was of very few is that people were able to log in and support festivals outside of the two or three they budget for because they're so expensive to travel to. And so people were like, oh, wait, there is good film everywhere. And it's starting to become that larger conversation.
With regard to sustainable careers for indie filmmakers, do you see any working model? Like, I don't see any working model. Do you see one where filmmakers in Mississippi or in Kansas are able to make films, make money off their films that then fuel the next project?
I'm not trying to just plug Hammer and Nail because I write for it. But I brought this up actually in a producing panel at Tallgrass because Noah Lang had This Is Not a War Story here. And he had written an article.
We interviewed Talia.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Great. Yeah. So the whole SVOD model is an interesting one. I don't think it's the long-term solution. So I don't know. I wish I knew. I don't have the answer. I'm not the right person for that question, I don't think. No, I don't.
Yeah, I don't think there's one person in the world who has the answer to that question.
I think everyone's trying to at least think of it, though. I mean, I read lots of interesting things, but that's not my my area. I'm just trying to help the fledgling startups. So,
like, as filmmakers come to you, I'm sure they've asked you that question. How do I make money? How do I do this long term? Do you have an answer that you usually give them?
It changes. So when I started 20 years ago, I volunteered all the time because I had a real job and it was my side weekend gig. And that was great. But that took a long time to lead to any sort of economic payoff. And not everyone can afford that. And not everyone has that opportunity. Some people have four or five jobs, but they're also really creative. So here in Kansas, literally our first film alliance, that was question number one is, how do we start making money? And it's like, well, are you paying attention to like what's filming in the area that you could drive to and you could work as local? Are you doing a PA job? Oh no, I'm a DP. I'm not a PA. You know, it's like, okay, well, sometimes on the bigger sets, you have to kind of just start somewhere and get your foot in the door. And then they think of you the next time. So there's a lot of that sort of like, oh no, I'm supposed to start at the top. That's the only option I have. And so just trying to remind people that sometimes you just have to work on a set and learn before you become, you know, a $3 billion budget director. So.
Yeah. And I think also just like realizing that $3 billion budget director thing is only for a very small percentage of people. And that's okay. You know, like not everybody has to make movies with big budgets. Like you can make movies on, you know, micro budget for the rest of your life and, you know, tell fulfilling, interesting stories. And I think that's one of the things that, like, you know, I'm seeing or we're seeing through the podcast, you know, some of the people who are continuing to make movies are making them at these like really low budget levels.
Yeah.
And not like doing $5-10 million movies, you know, because,
yeah,
like where are those budgets coming from? You know, like very, very small places, very few places.
Right. I think that's always been an issue, especially in indie film, is like who's going to just underwrite that sort of large chunk when they could probably have some return on like 500,000. Yeah, I think that's the penultimate question in our field.
Well, as a producer, you know, do you do any fundraising? And like, if so, like, what are your sources for the funds? Like, do you have like certain investors you go to or certain like, I don't know, like companies or something? Or like, how does it work?
Yeah, I have a handful. And then documentary has very different, like there's so many more great grant resources and humanities councils, and everybody seems to want to fund that sort of story. And then really mostly I've worked in a lot of the horror field, which does have people that like it and it does have some return. And so I have a handful of sources that are like, if this isn't for you, who do you think? And then sometimes we work on no budget because I didn't do a great job. So yeah, and then I've crowdfunded three times successfully. One time I failed, and I learned a lot from all four.
Just, you know, to copy Liz and do follow up after follow up. Looking back, like, can you see why that one crowdfunding campaign failed? Like, was there something that you did differently, or was there something different about that project that ended with that result versus the successful result of the other three?
Yeah, it's my difficult documentary that's still not out. The first crowdfunding, I actually had an amazing producer. He worked at a big studio and then retired to Mississippi and loved the idea, was kind of personally funding it, brought in a couple investors, but we needed some more funds. So we decided to do, I think it was Indiegogo. No offense to them, that's not why we failed, but we have a very difficult subject, and I won't name him because he watches me on the internet constantly. But we didn't realize, because we thought the story was so clever and so interesting, how many people he had pissed off. And in the South, once you burn a certain bridge, people will not support, no matter who you are. And so I had sort of my usual people that would like chip in. There wasn't the crowd that we thought would really respond to this. And we even did like a public concert, had all these amazing music, like all this cool stuff. And the public had lost interest in the story already. And it was like a year and a half in. So it really, really didn't give us our finishing funds. And this person is an impersonator of a very famous musician. I won't say who, but it costs a lot of money for the rights of anything, even imitating him on camera. So it still sits there with studios looking at it going, ooh, do we want to invest that much in clearing this? So yeah, that's why. It was really the subject and more than anything. All the others, you know, we kind of do the usual. My Kickstarter one I did, my first one, Where I Begin, which is a feature, was really successful because, and this is so sad, and I don't think they would do this today, but at the time, I guess 15 years ago, they're like, a film in Mississippi? Who's doing that? And so they like featured it on the front of Kickstarter. Like, look, people are making movies other places. It was like, okay. I mean, we got eyeballs outside of eyeballs we could ever reach. So it was wonderful.
Ark, I'm ready to go to the next set of questions. Are you ready?
I have one more question, which I just have to ask because, you know, being such a, you know, so rooted in film festivals, like when you get into a film festival as a filmmaker, there's all this advice to do all these different things, like, you know, print out brochures, like do this, like, you know, reach out to these, you know, newspapers to like write about your film, blah, blah, blah. Like, what do you think is like the most valuable thing to do as a filmmaker, like once you get into a film festival?
Talk to the locals to shut up to your film and ask them for their feedback. I had one filmmaker out of 45 features this year bring a survey with her to hand out to her audience and capture their emails. One. And she used to work at a film festival, so she knows. It really, I mean, you can be written up in the local paper. And sure, that drives sales for sure. But if you're a jackass or don't show up to that festival, you're just a film they watched and they can't even remember what year or what title. It's like that thing. But if you're the one that was there and you're like, oh my gosh, thank you for coming, and talk to them really one-to-one, go afterwards in the lobby, show up at the party and talk to the people that are your audience. If you saw them, you know, those people become beloved. And I know Milan was on your panel. He was just a juror at our festival, but he, you know, his whole thing at every festival is to really be present and people remember him, because we had all these amazing Liz Cardenas, who won last night for 7 days at Spirit Awards. She was there, but she's more like me. She's a little more, you know, a little introverted. She can be more extroverted, but Milan Chakraborty is sort of everywhere. There's a presence.
I mean, it's the jumpsuit.
He is remembered,
right?
Everywhere.
Yeah. Like,
it's the clothing a little bit. Yeah. And I've tried to tell this to filmmakers, people remember personalities, not necessarily your film title. I've seen thousands of films. I don't remember all the titles ever.
Do you remember Chris Gore's book, The Ultimate Film Festival Survival Guide? Okay. So I remember reading that before my festival premiere, and he was talking about, I can never say his name, Todd Stolen, you know, whatever, like the most amazing filmmaker ever. Happiness. And he was talking about Miranda July. He was talking about all these people who had like a distinct look. And he was like, that's what you have to do. You have to get a crazy haircut or dye your hair. And you have to do anything you can to stand out. There's no question. I just wanted to share that.
No, it's right, though. I mean, unless you hit that superstar celebrity where everyone recognizes you. Like, yeah. I mean, Milan has it right. John Wildman out of Dallas has it right. He always wears a suit and tie. And I'm like, ugh, I wear a t-shirt and jeans like everyone else. And nobody remembers who I am. So.
Well, on that note, what's the first film you ever made and how do you feel about it now?
Yeah, Where I Began was actually my first. It was a feature. And I, again, was running the film festival, and a filmmaker we had there said, do you mind just reading my script for notes? Because I've been doing that forever for friends. I said, sure. And it was about a woman who was raped. the guy comes back to town, and it felt very hollow, and it felt very male perspective of clearly somebody who's never even been around a rape victim. So I said, well, I just have a few, you know, constructive criticisms. And he said, he called me, actually, he didn't respond. He called me and was like, everything you said is exactly what I can't figure out. Would you please help me write it? And I was like, sure, yeah, you know. So I spent a day or two writing one scene, which is still my favorite scene in the movie, not just because I wrote it, but it's still like, I don't know, it just resonates with me even today. The rest of the film, we had a very inexperienced crew because we had low budget. It's okay. It's fine. It's not the worst or best first film, I guess. But I learned more doing that feature than I would doing 20 shorts, because anything that could go wrong did. We set off a fire suppression system in a restaurant, and we didn't have insurance, thinking we'd be clever and under the radar. The director ended up being pre-Me Too, one of the early Me Too adopters of the opposite side. Very horrible person to work with. So there was a lot of really awful, awful things. And I was like, this is what filmmaking is. And then I had to be the one that everyone kept going to and solving it. And I don't know why. I should have run very far. But instead I was like, I love this. I'm going to make all my sets way more safe, and got really super into it. So I feel very complicated about my first film.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
And I honestly, I don't even know if I'm quoting somebody anymore, or if I read it, or somebody said it to me. Like, it's just been in my head for so long, I don't even remember who to credit to. So if you know, tell me. It is that the more movies you work on, the closer you'll get to the image in your head that you're trying to get out. And I love that, because we're all just learning. So
what's the worst filmmaking advice you've ever received?
some do.
Yeah, I don't know. I wish I had one go to. I guess maybe, I don't know. I was a female in the South when at the time there were only two male filmmakers in my area. So I got a lot of, I built the right crew and cast that didn't treat me like, oh, you're a female filmmaker, you know, but definitely dealing with locations and other places, and really more as a festival director, they would thank the male near me for doing whatever I just did. And I don't know that's advice so much, but I never had anyone say, you know what, you could stand up and say something. It was like, I'm trying to be polite, so I won't acknowledge that I'm actually the person. I wouldn't do that today. But yeah, I don't know. I never got that bad advice, but I kind of wish I had gotten that good advice.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
I just like interesting stories. I always have, since I think I wrote a poem first when I was 6. I just like telling stories. And so I like attaching myself to things that seem interesting to me. And I guess I'm already doing it. I don't have some, well, I would like this documentary to go away forever, actually, once it finally finishes. That's my big dream as a filmmaker, is to finally finish this one. But no, I don't know. I wish we all could live forever and could just keep making interesting stories. But I don't know. Sometimes it's good. I think slowing down the past 3 years has been helpful to focus in on what I really want to do rather than just throwing my energy everywhere.
If you could go back in time, what's the one piece of advice, or what would you tell yourself, your younger self?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I would have done exactly the same, because it's all been sort of all learning and leading to the next thing. I don't know. I mean, I love that I moved to Mississippi instead of New York. I love that I left LA to become a filmmaker. I love my story. It's weird. And it's opposite of almost everyone else. So I don't know. Maybe pick up a camera in high school instead of waiting till your 20s. That might have been nice. Yeah.
And then last question, is making movies hard?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, the podcast has the title right. So yeah, of course it is. That's why I think, was it Chris's film, Film Fest Secrets? It says of all filmmakers, like 7 out of 10 will never make a second film. There's like a huge number. Like, they'll try it once. They're like, I'm good. So that tells me, just statistically, the fact that you can even finish one, let alone a second or a third, or keep going. Yeah, it's hard.
How can people support you, support Tallgrass, and sell your wares, send them to where you want them to go?
I will soon be announcing a new documentary project with David Parks. He is the son of Gordon Parks. He's actually coming back to Kansas to film, just like his dad did. So I would love, personally, for people to check that out when it happens. And then Tallgrass, we have what we call Sofagrass, so you don't have to be in Wichita. You can watch films on your sofa and support us, which is always a great thing. Or submit your film, because we will do our best to be, you know, equitable and treat you well. We also do ticket splits at the door at our festival. So that's nice to actually make money as you're on the festival circuit.
So it is time for our segment, You're the Expert, which is a segment in which either listeners submit questions or our producer picks a topic on which we are experts. And this week's question is, Ulrich, you've been talking about people starting a film community in your hometown. I'd like to do the same in mine, but don't know where to start. Do you have some advice on getting other like-minded filmmakers together? Ulrich?
Yeah, I know not everyone's a Facebook person, but I feel like Facebook is a really good way to do this, to just find people who are in your area, like check out the community pages for the town that you're in, and then just do a little post, because every town's going to have a community page, most likely, unless it's like a really, 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 really small town. But even the really small towns usually do. So I would go on there, introduce yourself, say you're a filmmaker looking for other filmmakers, and bam, you'll get responses. I mean, I did that in Vallejo and I got like 30 or 40 messages or something. It was pretty crazy. And then a friend of mine who lives here decided to do her own community event inspired by my suggestion. And then we did it and I was on the panel and it was great. So, I mean, Vallejo is a pretty big town, you know, and we're like really close to San Francisco. So we had a lot of people from different parts of the Bay Area come. So, I mean, maybe it's not the same as like if you were in a really small town, but I do think that method does work. But yeah, I would just search for filmmakers in your area and yeah, reach out to them. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all these social media platforms, I think they're all good options. But what about you, Liz? What do you think?
Yeah, I think we've had a question similar to this in the past, and we recommended going to the local film festival and trying to connect with filmmakers in that way. But I also wanted to mention that Reddit is a really good resource in addition to Facebook. And Clinton Cornwell and I are doing these weekly hikes with filmmakers on Sundays at 10 a.m. And he went on Reddit and he posted to the Burbank Reddit for artists, I guess. And we got like 8 extra people on our hike. And the hike itself felt like a very benign place in order to, like a benign place for networking and getting to know filmmakers in the area. And I think that's good too, is like maybe it's not a explicit networking spot, but maybe it's a low-key activity where you could get to know people in a less pressurized space. So check out Reddit, check out Facebook. Do you have an alternate suggestion for us? Do you have any thoughts on our answers? You can send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies Is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Freimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for doing the social media. Thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. But most importantly, thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to you next week.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.